food that's good for the environment, good for the people who eat it, and good for the people who grow it.
They pick it so it's beautiful when it comes to market, and you get to enjoy that.
Local businesses is the first place that we can directly support somebody.
You've got to believe in what you do, and if you stick to that, then you're getting there anyway.
G'day, Steph Postuba with another Quicksand Food Podcast. Today I speak with Boris Georgiou from Delano Coffee in North Wollongong. Boris is one of the managers there. Delano Coffee is a specialty coffee supplier working out of their factory in North Wollongong. And as you'd expect with most specialty coffee, they pay very close attention to both where they source their beans, the process of roasting and production, and then also how they transfer that quality into the cup. They're always looking to increase the quality that they have, and they're a fantastic local Illawarra supplier. I had a great conversation with Boris, so I hope you also enjoy this chat with Boris Georgiou from Delano Coffee in North Wollongong. Do you want to just give us a background of Delano Coffee and, you know, what you guys do?
Our history. Okay, yeah, sure. So we have been around as Delano Coffee for about 7 years.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things is we didn't start out with the idea of doing what we do now.
Right, okay.
So in the beginning, it, you know, started sort of as a small startup. We had two founders, and they came from coffee equipment, so they'd both been working in the Australian industry, focusing very much on the equipment side of the business, and working with lots of roasters all around. And I think they liked something about coffee and about what was sort of happening at the time. The interesting thing, though, is that the company kind of started out, I guess, as a coffee company, not a specialty coffee company.
Right.
And there's this sort of very two different, like, they're two different things.
Did you say it was 6-7 years ago when it started?
About seven and a half years ago.
So the term specialty coffee wasn't very familiar with people back then.
No.
Yeah.
It's one of the great things we have in Australia is that we are probably the most progressive as an entire country.
Yeah.
So you've got like awesome little hubs of specialty coffee in California, the UK, in Scandinavia. And sort of, you know, peering around the globe. But Australia, across the spread, we have like one of the highest levels of coffee quality.
I agree.
And so we're very spoiled in that sense.
As a person that just likes to drink coffee, I see that in just having travelled as well, in just the quality that you get from your everyday cafes in Australia. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a decent cafe, chances are you'll make a pretty good coffee. But if you go overseas, it's really hard to find what I would regard as a good coffee in almost every country I've been to.
Yeah. Well, I find, because I travel a fair bit for work too, a lot of the time I'll go to a country. I use the example, last year I went to Berlin. It was just not a work trip, just a personal holiday. We were walking through Berlin and I saw, you know, what looked like a trendy little cafe. I went in, had a flat white. I was like, oh, that is like an Australian.
And it was run by an Australian.
But yes, it was run by an Australian.
Of course it was, yeah.
And that's, I feel like that's one of our, also in the coffee industry, that's one of our best gifts to the world, is all the expats leaving to take that culture across the sea.
I've had that exact same experience where I've been in a place and I've been like, good coffee in this area, and it's like, Kiwi-owned cafe, da-da-da-da-da, makes this nice coffee. It's like, well, you've got to go there. Or Australian-owned cafe, you've got to go there. You
know? Yeah. So across the board, we're sort of, you know, we're really blessed in that sense. And it's good because it also breeds competition. If so many people are making amazing products, then consumers go, you know, they're not going to settle for second best.
Mm.
And that kind of fuels the cycle of getting better and, you know, finding better coffees, really, and sort of serving them more transparently. So, you know, quite early, it was about 5 years ago, I sort of came into the mix. And I, you know, I came from a design background. I didn't really know a lot about the coffee industry.
Mm-hmm.
I'd worked as a barista when I was at university. And I just, the first thing I did is started researching. So, you know, what is coffee? Where, you know, how does the industry work? Who are, you know, people that we sort of would look up to? You know, and where do we want to go? And sort of, so the last 5 years has really been sort of redirecting who we are and what we do to that side of the spectrum. So I think, you know, people struggle to define specialty coffee. There's so many different ways to think about it. There are, you know, associations around the world that sort of have a definition of specialty being a quality score. So they're, you know, in our industry, we have the equivalent of a sommelier. They're called a Q grader. So their job is to grade coffee from origin, and they follow very strict protocols, and they have certain ways of tasting coffee, and they look for things like defects and qualitative scores. Now, that's great, and it's something that we follow in-house as well.
So is that across the whole board, these people that score coffee, that system of whatever it might be, accreditation or scoring, is run throughout coffee all around the world?
Yes. So the good thing about that is it's run by two associations. So the Specialty Coffee Association of America and the Specialty Coffee Association of Europe. And they've actually just merged to become a global Specialty Coffee Association. So there's an institute in California called the CQI, so Coffee Quality Institute, and they built this program of grading.
Yep.
And it's the program's the same, doesn't matter where you are in the world or what coffee you're tasting.
That's
you
great.
Can all score it on one sort of quality scale.
That's great.
So the designation there is, you know, coffees that score above 80 are technically then designated specialty coffee, and coffees that score below 80 are coffees that are called commodity coffee. Now I think that's a great system, because what it does is it's standardized, and it takes away an aspect of financialness from it all. Coffees that score really high on quality are very sought after, because as the coffee industry sort of grows, the greatest growth is actually in the top end of the industry.
Yeah.
So people that are focusing on specialty coffee. And that seems to be sort of one of the driving parts of that is taste. Does it taste good?
Mm.
Yes. Then taste is being a huge sort of, hugely impacted by terroir and agricultural processes and stuff at origin. Now the cool thing about that is, because it's, you have a product that is of a high quality and, you know, that is sought after, then naturally, you know, it attracts a higher price. So that's the other good thing about specialty coffee is, you know, these producers that are focusing on agricultural practice and growing to make awesome tasting coffee, secure much, much higher prices than producers that work with, you know, things like fair trade and, you know, greater commodity coffee.
Mm.
So that's one great thing that we like about specialty coffee, and it's sort of a way of saying, well, what is specialty coffee? Another way of defining specialty coffee, and this seems to be a uniquely sort of Australian thing, or, you know, the coffee hubs that I mentioned before, is this idea of transparency. So, you know, 15 years ago, you know, you had this idea of a coffee roaster would buy coffees from all around the world, and they would blend it, and it was sort of this mysterious process. You know, you wouldn't tell people what coffee you bought or where. You didn't talk about provenance. You didn't talk about processing. You didn't tell people what was the makeup of a blend, because it was your secret. You know, it was what made you a master roaster.
Yeah.
And specialty coffee seems to have sort of thrown that on its head. And it was very much pioneered in Melbourne. You know, like the roasters that can take credit for that, you know, are people like Seven Seeds, you know.
Yeah.
They were the first to sort of say, you know, this is what a single origin is. This is what coffee tastes like from one place.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't blend this in any way. And that, you know, that sort of, that was, you know, probably 10 years ago now.
Mm. It's still so young, hey, to think about.
Yeah, yeah.
It's only 10 years ago.
Yeah, no.
Like, I remember drinking coffee when I was, probably started drinking coffee when I was maybe 16, which is more than 10 years ago. And no one had any idea. It's like coffee was coffee. I remember working in a cafe when I was 16, and someone said, make that person a coffee, this is how you do it. And I kind of had no idea how to do it, no training, no nothing. Send out a coffee, and the customer's like, yeah, well, it's a coffee.
Yeah,
you know.
Totally.
So, yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
So this idea of the transparency, you know, let's talk about where the coffee comes from. Let's work, you know, let's build a relationship with the producer, you know. We actually started flying around the world, going to origin to meet the people we buy coffee from, working with, you know, a certain tier of brokers, because we still have to somehow get the coffee from there to here. But at least we, you know, we can go to the places which are producing the coffee. Mm-hmm. We meet people, we buy from them, you know, year and year again, and you start building a bit of a relationship.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that's kind of also where I guess specialty coffee is heading. It's, you know, it's about transparency, it's about relationships. And then probably I think the last thing that, in my opinion, really defines specialty coffee is just the advancement of the science behind it. You know, we understand so much more now than we did 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. You know, we have people in the industry talking about grinders, you know, looking at the way a grinder cuts coffee beans, you know, what happens to the particles, and then how does that influence extraction and flavor. We have coffee machine manufacturers looking at, you know, things like, you know, varying temperature at, you know, at the group head, or varying the rates of flow and pressure, and what does that do to taste. And, you know, we have producers in, you know, actually growing the coffee, playing around with, you know, processing methods. So what do they do with the cherry when they take from the tree before they dry it, the seed into, you know, what we call the coffee bean, and send it on. So, you know, playing with fermentation. So, you know, using techniques that have come from winemaking, like carbonic maceration, and different types of very focused bacteria strains to produce different fermentations. You know, we're looking at different varietals. So we'd start talking about, like, 10 years ago, you would go into a supermarket and you would say, oh, I'm going to buy some coffee beans. And you would see the bag and it says 100% Arabica. You know, and you'd think, right. Oh, yeah. that's good quality coffee because it doesn't have any Robusta in it. But, you know, to say that something is 100% Arabica is like saying something is 100% an apple.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, when we go to the supermarket, we say, all right, there's a Granny Smith apple, there's a Pink Lady, there's a Red Delicious. And now, you know, we're sort of talking about, well, inside Arabica, there are, you know, all these different subspecies,
yeah.
You know, and they have different flavors and they're grown differently and we look at them differently. And even, you know, talking about sort of, you know, Arabica's less, well, as well known, but less thought of cousin Robusta. You know, we have producers now who are growing Robusta and treating Robusta in a very specific way, where the results are of a cupping quality that we associate with Arabica.
Yeah, okay.
There's actually a new stream coming from the grading side, which is the Coffee Quality Institute and the Specialty Coffee Association, where they have what they call an R grader stream, which is Robusta grading.
Oh, okay.
And there are Robustas that taste sweet and complex. And you know, are very low in defect, and they're emerging on the market now, which is really wild.
Yeah, that opens up a whole new world.
Yeah, so it's kind of like you have this idea of, you know, quality, just quality in the cup, and transparency and where it's from, and then the science goes into it. Yeah. And that's kind of, you know, that's where you differentiate what is specialty coffee versus what is greater coffee.
So going back to this original decision for Delano to become a specialty coffee roaster and to be a part of this sort of developing industry, can we go back to sort of how that initial decision was made? Was it partly sort of like your input and your interest, or like whose
I think
interest in specialty coffee sort of made that change?
It was sort of, I guess, it was a bit of a team thing. It wasn't sort of one person saying, no, this is what we need to do. It was more just, you know, as we became aware of what was happening in the grade industry, we saw what was happening, and we liked it, you know. I mean, everybody wants to come to work and have fun and enjoy what they do. And so we thought to ourselves, you know, what are things about this that interest us? Mm. I personally really love the science behind coffee. Mm. I really engage with that. You know, I like to research, I like to test and trial change. Mm. You know, we like the idea of actually going to where coffee comes from, exploring origin. And I think the first trip we ever made was actually to West Java. So we visited a cooperative up there called Classic Beans in the hills around Bandung. And you kind of, I guess you have moments where, you know, in any career in any industry that really drive, oh, this is what I'm doing and this is why I'm doing it. And I remember for us that trip, and when, you know, and some of the stuff we saw and what we learned was one of those sort of moments where it's like, wow, we this is our job. This is what we get to do to earn a living.
Yeah,
you know?
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, we just trekked up into the hills and we were on a small plantation, you know, and this cooperative was, you know, really, really impressive because in a lot of coffee producing nations, you'll have a lot of time like government run stuff and then you'll have, you know, people that are trying to do their own thing. And the cooperative is definitely that. So, yeah. You know, it's a cooperative of, I think it was about 400 smallholder farmers.
Yeah, wow.
So every farmer had maybe 1,000 square meters of coffee plants that was their plants.
Yeah,
and, you know, and then sort of eight of the probably the most experienced senior farmers sort of ran the day-to-day operations because they built their own mill. And it was during this process, we were at the mill and we were sort of cupping coffees because we wanted to buy some of the coffees. And there was a coffee that was what we call a honey process. So a honey process coffee is where the they pick the coffee cherry. And what they do is they take off a little bit of the pulp. So they sort of, they depulp it, but they leave a lot of stuff, like a bit of the flesh and the silver skin and stuff and mucilage around the two beans or cherry seeds inside the coffee cherry. And then what they do is they dry it and they allow it to sort of ferment in that method.
Yeah.
And what, you know, normally what they would do is if they were making a wash process, they wouldn't let it dry with that mucilage on. They would throw it in water and they would let it soak, and that effectively releases the seeds out of the mucilage. Now, honey processing historically didn't really have a huge place in coffee because, you know, it's quite a hard thing to control. You need to sort of understand the process to get a really good quality product out at the end. But I remember we had a coffee that they, some cherries that they brought in from another place in Indonesia called Sulawesi. And they'd applied a honey process to them. And when we cupped it on the table, it just, this coffee reminded me of pan-fried bananas. Like, that's all I could think about. I was sipping it and it was just like, is that, you know, that lightly caramelized banana sort of fritter style taste. And it was, that was all I tasted. And I was just kind of like, whoa, what is this? We have to get this.
Yeah.
You know, this is not coffee. And I think for a lot of people in coffee, that is the experience that brings them to coffee, is that when they taste the coffee and they're like, that doesn't taste like coffee.
Yeah.
Another experience that was similar around the same time was that I had a coffee from a farm in Panama, which was a varietal of coffee called a geisha.
Yeah.
And it was from a farm called Don Pepe. And this coffee, the way it was grown, so the terroir of that farm, the volcanic soil, produced a coffee cherry and a seed that was really high in acetic acid.
Yeah.
Much, much more than normal. And acetic acid is sort of, when you smell acetic acid and taste it, and it's, you know, you also have sugar there, it gives you, it's kind of like a strawberry.
Yeah.
And this, when you ground this coffee and you smelt it, it smelt like Nesquik, the strawberry Nesquik. It was crazy. You would think, like, has somebody flavored this somehow, but this is actually how that one coffee sort of produced, and it tasted amazing.
Yeah.
And so again, it was the sort of those moments that made us go, we can live and work doing this, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we?
Exactly. Yeah. If you and I think that in any business, if the people running it have a passion for and a real keen interest in their product and a motivation to continue to chase quality, that's what keeps that business vibrant as well. If you can't stand behind what you're giving people, and you let an experience like that drift away and go down some other route because you think that it might make you more money or whatever it might be, like the success rate for that sort of thing just isn't there. You need to be able to have a team and an ownership of a business that stands behind the quality and takes those experiences like you talk about and uses them.
Well, I think one of the interesting things, and it's something that I've thought about recently as sort of we've grown as a business, is that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we're never sort of sitting there wondering, oh, how are we going to grow and, you know, how are we going to, you know, like continue to expand and, you know, do we don't really, I know it sounds weird, but we're kind of not really worried about money.
Yeah.
But most business owners, that's always the first thing on their mind. most of the time we're just trying to think of, oh, what can we do next? What's fun? Like, what are we, you know, what are coffees that we can find? Who are people who, you know, that we can train and sort of work with to make this coffee taste awesome?
Mm.
And that's sort of the biggest thing that we kind of, our biggest worry, and it's, I think it's the same worry that every coffee roaster has, is that we have this network of people who at any given moment can make a decision that affects the quality of the produce that we serve.
Mm.
You know, and that's probably our biggest stress, which is, it's an interesting stress for a business to have. Mm. You know, we just seem to organically grow every year.
Mm.
And that's a really good thing for us and a good thing for what we're trying to do. But yeah, our stresses are maybe different to other owners. And I think that really comes from that idea of, you know, yes, like, start with something that's really good at space and, you know, just put your time and energy into that.
And I think that, like, what you're talking about as well is, like, not necessarily worrying about the economics of every decision you make, is there's, like, this sort of inherent confidence that your product's high quality anyway and it'll sell because there's a market for it and you don't waver from quality, which means that you've got this sort of confidence behind you that you'll still sell your product, and pushing forward is the thing that's going to help you grow, because, you know, finding new and creative things that interest you is the thing that's going to help you grow, because the quality's already there, the ethos is already there to bring something to market that's going to sell.
No, that's definitely right. And I think, but it's something that we have that, like I said before, is quite unique in Australia, because our coffee quality standard is really high across the board. You know, that competition breeds further quality.
Yeah.
But the thing about the coffee industry, and it's something that we notice a lot because we see from producer through to roaster, through to cafe, through to, you know, the consumer that drinks the coffee in the cup, is that we don't pay enough for coffee at the cup level.
Yeah, okay.
It's really crazy. You can, you know, you can walk into a cafe and you can have a flat white or a cappuccino or a latte, and you pay $3.50 to $4, depending on where you are. Now, the coffee that went into producing that cup of coffee could be, you know, low-grade commodity coffee that, you know, sort of, I mean, it's really hard to sort of comment on what pricing is, but let's just say not a lot of money was paid for it.
Mm.
And then it was roasted really, really dark and, you know, homogenized out of what was potentially unique about that coffee, or also what was defective about it. Or on the other hand, you could have had coffee that, you know, has a comes from, you know, a quality focused buying system, is roasted to try and stay true to its terroir and provenance as a coffee, and, you know, is put through equipment that cost a cafe owner $20,000-$30,000 to put on the counter, baristas that have been training and, you know, are really conscious and careful about everything they do, and you get the two cups and you pay the same price for them.
That's interesting.
And the thing is, the only way that it currently works is because the cafes that make a lot less money off that one cup of coffee just end up selling a lot more. Because that is it. Like, at the end of the day, consumers, you know, they pick with their taste buds. They'll drink a coffee and go, oh, that's a really good coffee, I'm going to come back here. Mm. You know, but it's I think it's a conversation that, you know, as the world changes and as, you know, people expect more and more and more from coffee, we will eventually have to have that conversation of, you know, coffee at the consumer level is too cheap.
Mm.
You know, a cup of coffee like the second one that I spoke about shouldn't be $3.50, $4, should be $6, $7.
Yeah.
You would still enjoy it just as much, but that would be a much more realistic.
Yeah.
It's
going to catch up at some point as well, because all the other costs are going to continue to go up.
Yeah,
coffee can't always be $4 a cup. Like, I was talking to a chef about this, and it's similar within the restaurant industry. It's like, no matter what restaurant you go to, $30 is a pretty decent price to pay for a main course, if you know what I mean. Like, but it's the $30 mark's been like the high main course price for ages.
Yeah.
And the cost of staff, the cost of electricity, the cost of everything else has gone up. But it's that $30 mark for a main course, or the $4 mark for a cup of coffee, that's that sort of high-end price that's stayed the same for such a long time.
Mm.
So, yeah, like, I don't know. It has to get to a point where the consumers understand that you know, the new benchmark for a quality coffee is now you're going to pay $4.50 for your flat white, or you're going to pay $5 for your flat white, you know, because it just it's all going to catch up eventually. You can't always have $4 as the price of whatever.
Well, and the other thing too is in the last sort of 5 years, a lot of producers and a lot of roasters and a lot of sort of organizations to do with the first part of the coffee supply chain, we've seen and we've been talking about what's happening at origin. So, you know, climate change, you know, has created an environment where insect damage and fungus strains attack coffee plants, and you know, you know, the industry are sort of helping out, doing things in a, to sort of mitigate this. So, you know, exploring new hybrid varietals. So, you know, using agriculture to try and work around that. You know, new processing methods that allow producers to more accurately produce higher quality coffee that they can then sell for more money. Therefore, they don't need to produce as much. You know, those are all things that are happening, but they will eventually sort of slide their way down the supply chain. And it will affect how we drink our coffee.
Yeah.
The other huge thing is this, you know, the emergence of coffee in Asia.
Yep.
So this is something that is relatively new. And it's really interesting. Historically, throughout Asia, so China, India, Japan, you know, people were historically very much tea drinkers. And it's sort of in the last 10 years, 15 years, there's this new kind of undercurrent, and it's really driven by the youth of drinking coffee. And it's kind of a, I guess it's a throwback to sort of this, you know, sort of Western influences that have, you know, permeated through culture. But because of that, you know, you have an environment there where, you know, there is a lot of advancements already happening in coffee globally. So they're sort of starting much further than, you know, a lot of Europe did with, you know, ideas and notions of coffee. And, you know, every year around the world you have this sort of you've got competitions and auctions for, like, we call them Cup of Excellence or Best of auctions. And the biggest buyers in the last 6 years have been Asia. China and Japan and Taiwan. You know, they're paying super high prices for quality coffee. And you know what? They're actually charging the proper amount you would charge for a cup of that coffee in those markets, because they don't have preconceived notions about what it should cost. But the thing about that is, when you have big markets start deciding they want something that everyone else wants, you then create competition. And it's good for producers, because producers can sell their coffee at a higher price. And it's you know, it's good for, you know, the industry to develop, because it's a big market that wants something of a certain quality. But what that means though is for the existing markets like Australia is that, you know, we now need to compete. Therefore we need to spend more at coffee origin, and we need to, you know, prices will go up, and that will eventually make its way down the supply chain as well. And you know, it's not going to be huge drastic differences. We won't be in a position where, you know, we have to pay $20 for a flat white. But, you know, yeah, I'd say $4.50, $5 in the future will sort of eventuate for that to continue in the way that it does
It'll
now.
It'll have to. Let's go back to Delano. So, I guess, at the start, like, when you guys did sort of go down this line of specialty coffee, there wasn't anyone else in the Illawarra doing it.
Well,
or was
no, not really. There's not actually that many roasters in the Illawarra. It's quite a large place. You know, we've got a bigger population than Tasmania. But yeah, we kind of, you know, we're sort of one of the first roasters of the Illawarra. There's another local roaster, Swell Coffee. He's been around for about the same amount of time. And that's slowly changing. And it's sort of changing all around Australia. We're seeing more and more what we call micro roasters, sort of startup shop. But we were sort of, I would say we're probably one of the first. We're definitely the first to really focus on the quality aspect of coffee.
Have you found a sort of a good embrace by local cafes and sort of food culture and the hospitality industry in the Illawarra?
Yes, definitely. We, you know, we wouldn't be who we are if we didn't, you know, have the relationships with our wholesale accounts. So, you know, that's been huge for us. And we have a quite a sort of a good spread from, you know, as far south as Bermagui, even further.
Awesome. Yeah.
All the way up to, you know, southern Sydney, throughout Sydney.
Yep.
We actually, funny enough, and this has all sort of happened organically, we have people that used to work at cafes that used our coffee throughout New South Wales that have then moved interstate and opened cafes of their own. So we actually have, we've got a whole bunch of accounts in far north Queensland, so around Cairns and Port Douglas, which seems very weird.
That's a long way to go.
Yeah, yeah, it is a very long way to go. But, you know, they're actually incredibly successful cafes in those areas as well.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then on the convex of that, we also have a whole bunch of cafes that use our coffee down in Hobart. So okay, in Tasmania, yeah. So it's sort of the top of the East Coast and the bottom of the East Coast as well.
That's cool. do you have sort of systems in place to ensure that the quality and attention to detail that you put in this facility translates into the cup when it's served to a customer in a cafe in Hobart or North Queensland?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things we do. So first of all, our coffee roasting plant, even though we're sort of, you know, a boutique producer and we're focusing on specialty coffee, we are actually HACCP certified.
Mm-hmm.
So that means every year we are audited, and we have really, really stringent handling and processing controls around how we produce coffee, which is really good for us and it's really good for the cafes that serve the coffee. Before we actually get to the cafes, our in-house team, in terms of quality control, we are cupping coffee from origin every week, you know, sometimes multiple times a week. And our buying program is very much based around being true to seasonality in coffee.
Okay.
And also modifying our blends quite a lot, so mm-hmm. that we're sort of going for the same taste profile. That's historically what a blend really is for. It's to take different coffees from different places, because coffee being an organic product is seasonal, and blending it to create a flavor palette the same way you would blend a perfume or mm-hmm. you know, or even like brew a beer,
mm-hmm.
Is you want it to taste a certain way. So yeah, so we're really, really proactive in that sense. And then yeah, we've got a training department. So we've got several staff members who are exceptional baristas themselves, and we've built a training program. So we go and provide training to our wholesale accounts multiple times a year. We run a school here.
Yeah,
and we actually travel to the accounts to train them as well.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. And that's, like I said before, that's one of the worries, I guess, of a roaster, is that, you know, in the production of espresso, everything, there are so many things that can affect it. It's crazy. And because, you know, we're using such small values, so, you know, small amounts of coffee, small amounts of water, accurate temperatures, accurate pressures, time, you know, and then people, you know, we have close to 70 wholesale accounts, and across those accounts, you know, let's say across all of them, each account would have an average of 6 or 7 baristas. That's like 500 people.
That's a lot of that variables.
At any given point can make a decision that will affect a cup of coffee.
Yep.
So we definitely try our hardest to sort of, you know, do what we can do, both from, you know, sourcing and roasting through to, you know, trying to only use specific equipment brands and models, because mm-hmm. we know them, we know how they need to be serviced, how they react, how they make our coffee taste, and then yes, training. But you know, it's like any chef will tell you, you know, hospitality is a people business. Very rarely will you have people work in hospitality in one place for a very long time. So yeah, that's kind of the support that we give our wholesale accounts. We're not that classic coffee roaster that just throws, you know, branded crockery and umbrellas and wind barriers and all that stuff at them. No, we try to focus on training.
Yeah, cool. An observation of mine, and it's probably through watching what's happened with Campos, is that when an artisan organization, whether it be coffee or wine or whatever it might be, is small, it's viewed that there's quality, like inherent, there'll always be inherent quality because it's small and it's managed. But then once it's upscaled, people, it can sometimes lose that identity of like true quality. And I sort of remember I used to think that Campos was the best coffee you could possibly get, and now not so much, because I don't know about their practices, but you just see it everywhere, and that's sort of just an association that happens. Do you find that that's sort of like hard to sort of like upscale, but at the same time retain an identity of real attention to quality?
Yeah, it's interesting. Coffee is in an effect fashionable.
Yeah.
So you've also got that problem of fashion changes, and fashion cycles are getting faster and faster and faster. Now, Campos, 10 years ago in Newtown, they pioneered certain aspects of the way we produce coffee. What they were doing at that time is not really what the industry, progressive side of the industry does now. And in some aspects, they haven't really changed their ethos. But that being said, like you said, they've grown really big, and it's hard to scale up everything you do and just continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Mm. There's sort of a point where things must change, because that's economies of scale.
Yeah.
Last I heard, Campos had 550 cafes across Australia that serve their product. So, on that same idea, that's 5,000 people that can make decisions every day that affect something, that really at the end of the day, it's so hard. It is so hard at that point to, keep that, to keep the delivery of quality. It's not, I don't think, I don't like to speak ill of any company ever. I don't think, from a management and from that perspective, that they don't want to produce quality coffee. They buy some great coffees. I just think that when you're that big, it's really difficult to actually apply that.
Does that mean that for Delano, there might be a bit of a critical mass when it comes to what you guys do, or?
We have definitely discussed that in-house. There is a point of, where we've decided where, we will get to this size, and I'll be honest, it's probably only 10% of what someone like Campos is now.
Yeah.
Where we, the decision to continue to grow can be taken in two ways. So one of the ways we want to do it is, okay, we're at a point where, where our growth is, really big for what we are at this point in time. And what we can do is we can focus on the way we run our business. So efficiency, we can focus on clients. It might be that at that point we up the ante on our training, and we sort of like new clients come on board and old clients leave us. You can run a business like that. I personally prefer that method, because I feel like and I see this in a lot of other roasting companies, they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they get to a point where, all right, we need another roaster, we need a bigger facility, we need to double our team. And those things, that point of scaling up is really hard.
Mm.
It's really hard to keep true to what you're doing. So I think our idea is there is a point where we'll get to where it's just like, it's a great business and we can sort of continue to have fun.
Yeah.
But growing so big is not really critical at that point.
Yeah.
I feel like at the end of the day, you also have that problem, the bigger you get, the more stressful everything gets. The more people you have, the more, the more people are reliant, the more opinions from clients and all this sort of stuff happens. And it's just kind of, I don't know. It's a really intense part of what the business cycle is. I have a couple of friends who, have worked in hospitality and restaurants on a large scale, on a small scale. And they say that, running a 50-seater restaurant is a whole different ballgame to running 5 50-seater restaurants, which is a different ballgame to running 1 300-seater restaurant.
Yeah.
There's all these things that come into play, and you can run any of those three models and make a really good livelihood and have fun and do all these things. But at the end of the day, I personally would prefer to run something a bit smaller, and maybe try to work on a customer base that is happy to pay for a certain product, that has a certain margin attached to it, and we sort of all win in that sense.
Mm.
Yeah.
Just changing direction a little bit. Was the coffee house always here?
Actually, this is kind of funny. So this is part of that journey of, you know, what, who we are. So at the beginning, we, you know, we had our brand of coffee, but then we had a coffee house and we named it something completely different.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And it was kind of like, you know, that was part of the journey of, well, you know what, this is where we showcase what we think coffee can be and how we like to produce it. So we sort of merged them and renamed it after the brand.
Yeah, okay. Is the coffee house sort of a bit of a hub where you can educate the public on what you do out the back as well?
Yeah, we try to. You know, it's the idea with, and this is also looks at the evolution of who we are as a company. The idea is we treat the coffee house as the cellar door.
Yeah.
So
that's what it feels like.
Isn't it? Yeah, yeah. So the idea is you can come in, you can, you know, drink coffee. There is, you know, some seasonally focused sort of cafe food attached to it because we have to be honest, nobody comes just for coffee.
Yep.
And we're not, you know, we're in an industrial estate because we're a roaster. So we need something to complement that. But also then we have sort of our retail section where we have, you know, every week we have different micro lots come through. You can buy the coffee. You can speak to someone about how you make it. We've got implements to make coffee. We've got a training school where we run, currently we run barista courses. But one of the things we're working on is actually a coffee appreciation course.
Okay,
so this is a course designed for people that want to make coffee at home, not necessarily working in the industry, and you know, they just want to know more. They want to understand, well, what is coffee?
Yep.
And then, yes, how are the different ways I can make it? What do I need to look for? What are things I need to think about? So that's something we're sort of putting together at the moment for launch a little bit later in this year.
That's really cool because I think that more and more now, I mean, as coffee grows and it just grows in conjunction, but people want to find the best way of making coffee at home.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there who know that pods are shit. And
not even that. I mean, it's pods is a whole nother, like, that, honestly, it's a nightmare for, yeah, for someone that understands coffee and sees what's happening. Ecologically, it's one of the worst things that we do,
yeah,
as a consumer base in Australia is buy coffee pods because, you know, they end up in landfill. It's these tiny little bits of plastic. It's, you know, it's as bad as the plastic bag.
Yeah.
I think I read a report that came out of Europe, and it was at the time Hamburg in Germany as a city banned pods from anything that they could. They banned the pods from, so government institutions, anything that, you know, had money from the public purse. And, you know, it sent these, you know, shockwaves in the market and this and that. But, you know, some very, you know, interested journalists started looking at, well, how many pods do we use? And I think in Europe, they were talking, you know, like 16 billion pods a year or something like crazy numbers. And, you know, pretty much all of them end up in landfill.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, to remember with coffee pods is coffee pods, in terms of a dose of coffee, is actually very low.
Mm.
I think, you know, there are probably coffee pods that have decent coffee in them. But it's just, you know, they roast it very dark and they use about half the coffee that you would use in a traditional espresso, yeah, machine to produce one espresso.
That's the thing. I mean, like, and that's what I mean about people and running an appreciation course or something like that, is that people want good coffee at home now. And, like, I think people realize, aside from the environmental impact of coffee pods and whatever it might be, it's just not good coffee.
Mm.
And people want to learn how to make it at home. And having downstairs, you guys having V60s and AeroPresses and, you know, grinders and all that stuff that you can take home and optimize coffee, and then also running an appreciation course where you can give people information about how to make really good coffee at home, that really sort of like helps in that way. And sort of, yeah, I don't know, I think for a long time, well, for me as well, you know, I always buy coffee from a cafe because I never sort of made really good coffee at home. But, you know, when you start, like, I make stovetop coffee at home now, and like when you start buying specialty beans and grinding it fresh and putting attention into it, you can really, you know,
yeah,
make
it
a good coffee
difference. Yeah,
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 you know, do it.
Yeah, no, and we kind of it's one of those things too, as the company grows, you sort of, I guess we can have more resources. So it's, you know, people have wanted this for a long time. The other thing we're planning on doing in the near future is having, like, I guess, you know, a bit like a like the Apple Genius Bar. So, you know, when you go into,
yeah,
Apple, like an Apple store, you know, they've got all the products there, but you can go sort of talk to someone, they'll run it through with you and the like. You know, we have this idea of, all right, let's, you know, Wednesdays every week we'll get some of the team that work behind the scenes and we'll run a Genius Bar for 2 hours. So members of the public can come in, they can, you know, they can bring their AeroPress from home, or they can, you
That's
know,
cool.
bring their grinder, or they can just come and ask about, well, this is what I'm doing and I'm not getting good results. How do I change that? Mm. Another thing I don't know, you know, a lot of some roasters do this is, you know, we produce little instructional cards and stuff like that. So all the products we sell downstairs, there's little cards that come with them that, you know, run through how to do it our way. It's not, I'm not saying our way is the correct way, but, you know, we've got a really interested team that sort of approach everything scientifically. So, you know, for example, with a pour over coffee, so, you know, we're grinding coffee, we're putting it in a paper filter and we're just running hot water over it at gravity, so one bar of pressure. There's different ways you can do that. The way we teach and the way we prescribe is, like, our method we find gets better quality of extraction, and that's, you know, sort of what I think a lot of people suffer with trying to make coffee home, is they under extract the coffee. They don't follow a process that's sort of proven to make a nice full bodied sweet round cup. So that's you know, that's probably one of the pitfalls of making coffee at home. It's crazy though, as much as, you know, we feel like we've progressed as an industry, I saw a business report that came out that a friend of mine who we buy equipment off, he passed on and said, oh, this is some interesting reading for you as a coffee roaster. And in Australia, 50% of all coffee consumed is still instant coffee. As much as we are a super advanced nation for coffee in general, 50% of all the coffee consumed in Australia is still instant coffee.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's, you know, and it's, you know, there, instant coffee is not a bad thing. It's actually, most people don't even know what instant coffee is. All it is coffee that's been brewed. So they take roasted coffee, they run water through it, and they end up with these big vats of coffee, and then they freeze dry it.
Yeah.
So they just instantly, they evaporate the moisture. So all you are doing when you're making instant coffee is taking coffee that was brewed and rehydrating.
Yeah.
And there are some interesting projects I've seen out there. There's a young startup in California called Sudden Coffee. And what they do is they take coffees of, you know, single origin, high quality, like, you know, unique terroir attached to them, and then they brew them very, very precisely, like you would expect from a very high end cafe. Then they dehydrate them, so you can have an instant coffee, that tastes.
The
high
Silicon
quality.
Valley Google workers that don't have enough time to
exactly. I can have a, you know, a washed Kenyan SL28.
I tell you what, I prefer to drink Blend 43 than drink pods.
Yeah, to be honest, you probably do less damage to the environment as well. No, but it's, I mean, it's like anything.
But yeah, it's funny that you say there's like, you kind of, being involved in the industry and, you know, enjoying the coffee and all that sort of stuff and knowing about it, like I, you know, I'm a bit of a coffee snob, obviously not the worst out there, but you sometimes can lose a bit of the perspective of where the industry is. And when you read a stat like that, it's interesting to go, well, there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, definitely. And the good thing and the thing that we like is that trying to stay progressive and trying to stay with, you know, what's happening very early on in the industry keeps us relevant.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like there is this nice growth of new coffee roasters appearing on the market. A lot of them starting off as micro roasters. And for us, you know, we think that's a good thing because... I mean, we found, you know, that doesn't really impact us as a business because we're not a macro roaster.
Yep.
The only people impacted are, you know, the people that produce coffee for the supermarket shelves, and the people that are the big, big roasters like Campos and Bella, and, you know, they're the guys that probably will, you know, over time lose market share and, you know. But yeah, no, it's really interesting the sort of rise of the micro roaster in the last 10 years as well.
Mm. But that's it, it's just 10 years. 10 years is such a small amount of time. Like, there's so much growth to happen, to continue. So.
And also what's been happening from, you know, just technology-wise in the last 10 years is crazy.
Mm.
You know, four and a half years ago, we started using a second level of software to analyze every roast we do. And that did magic for how we roast and the quality that we output. But, you know, for 100 years before that, people were roasting blind. They just, you know, it was like a big oven. They throw all the beans in there, spin around, they hit it with some heat,
it comes out, looks kind of right, smells kind of right, yep, we're good. Now we have I have a library of currently it's about 18,000 temperature curves.
Yeah.
So we have a history of every roast we've done for the last 4,000 years. four years. So it's like it's really wild, like that, you know, as technology's expanded. You know, I think the progression of what's happening in the industry is going to go crazy.
Yeah.
The next 10 years are going to be wild. Yeah.
It'll be an interesting landscape in 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're sort of... Yeah, we've done quite a bit. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about? Is there anything happening with Delano or, you know, your client base, other educational things that you guys do, anything else that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I think one of the things that we sort of started discussing as a team internally was, you know, the idea of communities within an industry.
Yeah.
It
seems to be about, very supportive, like you were talking about.
Yeah, it is, but I still feel like it's not there yet. So, right. You know, in the Illawarra, if we start at, you know, Helensburg and we work our way all the way down to Gerringong, there are a lot of cafes, there are a lot of baristas, there are a couple of roasters, there's a lot going on. And one of the things we tried to do over the last 2 years is sort of build events, not about, you know, promoting anything in particular. It's just, let's bring the industry together, you know, and have fun. So we've had a movie night where we watched a film about coffee. Mm-hmm. So it was a film made by an American filmmaking team, where they, you know, they interviewed a whole bunch of progressive American roasters based out of Portland and LA and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And then they went to Kenya, and you know, it was sort of like a, you know, it was a beautiful film, and it really spoke about what coffee could be, and you know, the idea to give people a bit of a background. We had a latte art smackdown. They got very heated because there was, you know, a couple hundred dollars on the line, and sort of, you know, and it was a knockout sort of style format. We've had ping pong nights, barbecues, and I think that's something that we really want to continue.
Yeah, getting the community involved.
Yeah, in
building a community.
Building a community around coffee, because, you know, that's how we all sort of expand as an industry.
Yeah.
And I think that that's also part of that idea of transparency, trying to be more and more transparent in every aspect of what we do. We're continuing our origin trips. We're continuing, you know, our buying program. To be honest, there's so many things
there's
going
so
on.
Much
you
to
know,
talk
it's
about.
Just like,
I,
yeah.
I think the word, that's and that's the that's something cool about the future of coffee as well, is that there is so much happening. Like, it's an interesting industry in the sense that it's all focused around this one thing, which is this coffee bean.
Mm.
And there's so much passion that goes into it on so many levels. So from the people that grow it, and places like Panama with Geisha that you talk about that are at the absolute top level of production, to people like yourself or other roasters and specialty coffee people from Australia taking production processes to them, and then, you know, cooperatives and collectives and community building at origin to transport to here, and then the absolute ridiculous amount of science that goes into roasting it and then preparing it, and then the people that just want to get a good cup of coffee, and then mm-hmm. coffee snobs as well. So like it's an interesting industry that it's all based around just this coffee bean and what can be done with it, but there's so much focus and passion that goes into all these different aspects. So
I honestly I can't think of what we've got coming up next. Actually, one thing we do is I personally am quite involved in the coffee competition side of the industry. So I'm an accredited World Barista Championship judge, and I went last year to Dublin and judged, which was so much fun. And sort of the last 4 or 5 years I've been, you know, judging at different levels in regional and national comps. I got to
run... That must be good to, you know, just for the business side of things, to just be able to get yourself exposed to the top level of what's going on in coffee throughout the world.
100%. Yeah. And it's really built my palate. It influences a lot of the decisions we make in the business. And it's also, it's good because it's fun. It makes the industry just so much fun. And you see the passion that other people put in there, and it inspires you.
Yeah.
We buy a brand of equipment from Italy called Della Corte, and you know, we love them as espresso machines. They're very high end, very good at what they do. And because we buy them and use them, I, you know, sort of built a bit of a relationship with them. You know, we sort of I talk to them a lot, and they have this team of people called DC Coffee Pros. And so, you know, I've built friendships with them. There's a guy from Melbourne who's one of the co-owners of Code Black Coffee. There's a guy from Mexico, Fabrizio. He came second in the World Barista Championship in 2012. And so, you know, hanging out with these guys and seeing how they think about coffee and what they're doing is just, it's crazy inspiring. Mm. You know, I kind of like, oh, every time I see them, I come back with 10 new ideas, and you know, sit down with the team, is like, guys, we're going to do this now, you know. Yeah, I want us awesome. To think about this, let's, you know, let's change this, and you know, and that's sort of yeah, that's probably, you know, what we've really captured from being involved at that level as well.
Yeah, awesome.
Cool. Yeah,
and my future.
Yeah, a lot of people I talk to, even family, friends, go, oh, coffee competitions, what's that now? Yeah. And it's like, that is our industry's equivalent of the Olympics.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
If I think about
serious sort business
of, yeah, it is actually, you know, they're like elite athletes. They have sponsorship deals, they
yeah.
use particular products, they use particular, you know, types of coffee from like specific farms. It's just, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, cool. No, it's a good exposure to go forward and take Delano into the future.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah,
cool. Boris, we'll leave it there. Thanks for talking to me.
No, thank you. Thanks for coming here, and thanks for interviewing us. We really appreciate it.
Mate, no worries.
Thanks for tuning in to my chat with Boris Georgiou from Delano Coffee in North Wollongong. If you want to find out more about them, you can check out their website, which is delanocoffee.com.au. And if you want to find out more about us, you can check out our website, quicksandfood.com, or you can find us at quicksandfood on social media. Get out there and get the book. The Illawarra Cookbook is available on our website, and at all good Illawarra retailers. We'll have a list on our website of retailers as well. Please support independent publishing. Please support local food. And thanks for listening to this Illawarra Cookbook Quicksand Food Podcast.